This is the Morgan Report with David Morgan. For the latest in precious metals investing, gold, silver, the economy, and more, go to themorganreport.com.
I'll read the quote from Ayn Rand. This is an excerpt from Atlas Shrugged. Quote, when you see that in order to produce, you need to obtain permission from men who produce nothing, when you see that money is flowing to those who deal not in goods but in favors, when you see that men get rich more easily by graft than by work, and your laws no longer protect you against them but protect them against you, you may know that your society is doomed. Hey everyone, thanks for joining us here on Reluctant Preppers. Asking for your help tonight because even though we have record numbers of subscribers here on Reluctant Preppers, trying to spread the word about preparedness and self-reliance and awareness, we've been receiving reduced revenue from our YouTube videos being marked as advertiser unfriendly and having to curtail the content and the descriptions and the topics and the guests that we can introduce. So with your help, we can overcome that and break free of that restriction. If you go to patreon.com/reluctantpreppers, you can make any amount of small or modest or larger monthly donation to help support our mission. We've established goals there to help bring you even more content with the different levels that we can achieve together. Thanks, folks. Check it out, patreon.com/reluctantpreppers. And now, on to our main event.
As a responsible person with growing concerns for your privacy and personal liberty, you want to know where we're headed and what you can do about it. We ask the experts what you need to do to take prudent and responsible action to safeguard your family's wealth and well-being, and what basic first steps will help you to be aware and prepared. ReluctantPreppers.com.
Welcome back, Reluctant Preppers. We're honored to have an important returning guest today, David Morgan, founder and host of The Morgan Report on the morganreport.com, is here with us again on Reluctant Preppers. David is also known as the Silver Guru. He is consulted widely, both by investors of the highest caliber in the precious metals markets, as well as a avidly sought after speaker at conferences about the silver market and the silver industry, about precious metals investing in the plight of our fiat system. David, thank you again for joining us here on Reluctant Preppers.
Well, Dunnigan, thanks for having me.
I was hoping today if we could delve into a few of the cover stories that are in your Morgan Report newsletter. I was noticing, first of all, a very provocative quote by Ayn Rand at the beginning, and then some interesting topics that I wanted you to delve into a little bit more deeply for the benefit of our viewers here. First of all, I'll read the quote from Ayn Rand. This is an excerpt from Atlas Shrugged. Quote, when you see that in order to produce, you need to obtain permission from men who produce nothing, when you see that money is flowing to those who deal not in goods but in favors, when you see that men get rich more easily by graft than by work, and your laws no longer protect you against them but protect them against you, you may know that your society is doomed. And that's from Ayn Rand from Atlas Shrugged. A lot of those characteristics seem to ring true of our current political economic system, and it takes me back, ironically, to my childhood when my mom would speak quite bitterly from her father and for her stepfather, growing up from the pit of the Great Depression, was just bitterly resentful of bankers and what they had witnessed of them repossessing people's farms and homes and that and property and that sort of thing. And I always thought, as a kid growing up, oh, it was all kind of overblown, or it was all kind of one-sided, or kind of exaggerated, or whatever. But as things have continued, and we've been through the near collapse of 2008, and now heading back towards the precipice again, it really I have a lot of deep resonance with a lot of those concerns that are outlined there. And I wondered if you wanted to expand on any of those, as far as you've been on here before talking about when we're near the collapse stage of an empire, talking about the four horsemen of the apocalypse and that sort of thing, but specifically picking any of those themes that Ayn Rand brought in there and expanding on where you see those evidence in today's economy and political scene.
Well, first of all, I agree that that quote is about as pertinent as it possibly can get. When I started the Morgan Report, I always wanted it to be a lot of things. But number one, it was the editorial, the first part of every report, to be thought-provoking. And that's obviously why I use quotes every month. This one in particular seems to hit the target as far as where are we exactly. And I don't want to divert too much from the main story, but two points. One is that my sister and I got an audio interview with my grandmother, and that sounds kind of ridiculous because, you know, she loves us and we had a close relationship. But we did it on a audio recording because we didn't want to lose it, because she had many stories about the Great Depression. But we, one day, a few years before she passed away, just sat her down, basically kind of went through everything that we could recall she told us over the years, and just had her kind of go through everything. And it's quite an eye-opener. And a sub-story of that was a large purchase made by a neighbor of hers. And the story goes that, and I forget what it was, tractor or something along those lines. And so the gentleman's all ready to, you know, get his check from this individual, and says, no, wait there. And says, no, you can come in. So the salesman comes into this house. Now, this is, you know, in the, like, 40s, early 40s or so. And this guy takes his coffee table, moves the area rug off, and there's, like, this lift door. And he opens this thing up and walks out into the basement, gets out the cash, and pays this guy. And he says, you know, since the Great Depression, I don't trust banks. So I'm just reaffirming what you said. And now, of course, to add on to that, we're in this position where the banksters want to make sure that there are no cash transactions. They're trying to outlaw cash, with India being the prime example of how they can crack down from an authoritarian perspective and basically run to a cashless society, which gives people even less freedom.
Yeah, and that's, you know, when you talked about when you need, in order to produce, you need to obtain permission from men who produce nothing. Often being able to produce means having access to capital, and access to capital means being able to transact. And there was even, we had Rob Kirby on recently who talked about the cashless pressure, that if you are can only transact electronically, then someone else can turn the off switch off on you, and your entire financial life can become just frozen up. And I guess moving from that to the bigger picture of the broader, the macro economy, you did deal with some of the principles of why gold, and I guess silver and gold, have stood the test of time, of being those rare assets that don't have the counterparty risk that almost every other type of asset that people will try to lean on can have, such as pension plans and et cetera. Could you address some of those for those of us who could use a reminder of some of, just because we all have family members, coworkers, people like that who will question, you know, why are you interested in this? And in part of being able to tell that, to answer that honest question effectively is very helpful to be able to articulate why is it that gold and silver have stood the test of time, and you specifically examine the counterparty risk aspect. If you could recap that for us.
Certainly, and I'm going to step up a little higher and look down even further, which means kind of get even a broader perspective, then I'll drill down into your question. You know, if you look at one of the better thinkers out there in our space is Martin Armstrong. Martin makes a case that, you know, gold is an inflation hedge. And that's really true. I mean, people think of it as an inflation hedge or a hedge against currency debasement. And I'd argue it pretty much is that. But if you really want to get into the academic side of things and make a big case about it, it's really a better deflation hedge than an inflation hedge. And that's that is not my work. That's done by Professor Roy S. Jastrom, who wrote The Gold Constant. The problem is there, you got to separate the wheat from the chaff, because a lot of times that he looked at the inflation deflation debate and where gold performed the best, oftentimes it was on a gold or a bimetallic standard. So you also have to sort that out. But regardless of whether it's better as a inflation hedge, better as a deflation hedge, I like Doug Casey, it's a crisis hedge. I like Martin Armstrong. It's against, you know, it's a hedge against government. But if you look even further, this is my view, it's a trust edge. It's when you don't trust those men that, you know, are, make get rich easily by graft rather than by work, that have laws that protect them against us, you know, the society is doomed. So it's really more than a crisis hedge from my perspective, and it is that, but it's a trust. What do you trust? And there's a direct correlation from the Roman Empire to current times, that there is a direct correlation that the debasement of a currency goes hand in hand with the debasement of the moral structure of the society, which is exactly what that quote deals with in all aspects. And of course, to give Frederick Bastiat his due, the book The Law has already done this. So this is back to Ecclesiastes. There is nothing new under the sun. We've been here, done that. The only thing that's quote-unquote different this time is that it's not just an empire, it's a global empire. So when this thing blows apart, which it already has, in my opinion, or started to in 2008. So now let's go down and drill. As I said, I would answer the question. So one thing I wrote about in the Morgan Report in the May issue that just came out about a week ago, and there's one thing the economy is facing, the possibility of, say, large-scale defaults on an auto or student loan as an example, but there's something else which the entire structure is permeated with counterparty risk made so due to excessive use of leverage or because many agreements were unstable at their outset and highly likely at some point to become untenable and subject to failure. Think pension plans, government-based insurance programs like the FDIC agreements, currency swaps, derivatives of almost all kinds. When you consider how numerous these examples are, you realize that the risk has become systemic. And systemic is a fancy word to say all interconnected. One domino hits two, two hits four. I say that in every interview. But the point is that something as far away as the Archduke Ferdinand could start the a world war going is like, oh, come on. But this is the butterfly effect. This is that throwing the pebble in the pond that you don't know how far those waves are going to ripple. So something that takes place in some obscure place somewhere on the planet could have a ripple effect that starts to take down your pension plan, as odd as that may seem. But it's all interconnected, and that's the problem.
And people who are regular listeners to this channel have heard, so I will just cap in a bullet point form that when the 2008 near collapse happened and Lehman Brothers was one of the casualties, we had in our household, we had no investments with Lehman, never. However, our investments with another broker in what they considered a cash equivalent money market fund on the backside, completely unknown to be unknowns to us, had leveraged things with Lehman. So when Lehman's went down, our so-called cash equivalent money market got frozen up for a long period of time. We never got all the money back. So it's absolutely true that the more interconnected these things are, and this is, they're interconnected in ways that the ordinary person absolutely is unaware of and doesn't understand it. And it's leveraged, it's magnified, it's multiplied. And that led into the next section of your talk. You mentioned complex systems theory. I don't know how different that is from chaos theory in the past. It seems similar. But you started to talk about some of Jim Rickard's work in explaining how you can end up with these exponentially increased levels of systemic risk. And then beyond that, what the stages are, how a breakdown plays out. So if you could just touch at a high level on why does a bigger, more complex system bring not just a linear scale up of risk? And then what are the stages of a breakdown?
Great. Well, thank you. And also, thank you for the real life example, not just to make, you know, drive the point home of what I'm saying is true. But it's always good to get, you know, real information from real people. I know we're both trusted for the most part. I'm sure there's trolls that, you know, dislike us, and that's fine. Why they bother to listen? They don't listen. They just write comments. I had one that wrote comments. It's obviously didn't listen to the interview, but it makes him feel better to put me down. So have at it. But anyway, so back to your question, the elements of a financial collapse. And we quoted Jim here, but there's five stages. There's repricing, and this is one that's sort of like low key. It's where the market revalues an instrument and moves from being overpriced to fair value. So that's what the market's supposed to do, or is constantly doing all the time. And that's like normal market activity. Then you get into acceleration, where the repricing goes below the fair market value, or overshooting effect, becoming a force multiplier is what he calls it, creating instability in the system. And a pause there. Yes, he is very close to chaos theory or entropy. I don't want to get too much in my engineering brain, but he does a good job. I like his thinking. I don't agree with him on everything, but I don't agree with anybody on everything. And that's the way it's supposed to be. We're all supposed to be self-starters and critical thinkers. The next one's transmission. At this point, instability jumps from the first sector and the disruption spreads into other unrelated and uncorrelated markets. Again, to drive home the point you just made, like seawater filling up the Titanic, now rising above the level of still of bulkheads, the problem begins spilling over into the other formerly safe levels of the ship. Next to last, irrationality. And, you know, markets run on psychology, not on math. Yes, there's algorithms, and yes, things can be overpriced. And yes, a PE ratio is something to look at. And there's all these metrics. And yes, do they work? Some of the time they do. But it's an emotion that drives people, mostly greed and fear. I would add greed, fear, and panic, because I think the 2008 was a panic situation. And I see that we'll have another one. And that goes back to where we started the interview, which is, what do you trust? When all else fails, you trust money that's been money for thousands of years, is totally outside the banker's purview and has no counterparty risk. And there's only about 1% of the population that understands what we're even talking about. But believe me, after it happens, there will hardly be a soul on the planet that doesn't get it. Now, I'm sorry I'm digressing, but if you go...
No, that's all right, because even on that point, I wanted to chime in that back in yeah, the run-up of after 2008, and then all the way when gold was increasing after that, even myself as a casual observer, and I really wasn't involved at this time, but just as a sort of a spectator in the culture, you started seeing everywhere you drove. It used to be just, you know, like pizza, tanning parlor, and whatever. Now it was, we buy gold. And then even at the mall, there was all these kiosks popping up with people, we'll buy your junk gold back, and on the TV all the time. So suddenly everybody was talking about something that nobody was talking about. You know, I say nobody, I'm sure you've been talking about it the whole time, but most people weren't talking about. Suddenly it became like the sign of the times. I mean, it became suddenly the buzz across the entire culture. So go ahead.
Well said. So the irrationality, if a market conditions hit the irrational level, I just read part of that. So this is why during the intermediate stages of a financial panic, gold drops in price due to the fact that liquidity enables it to be sold by market participants trying to protect their investments by meeting margin calls, et cetera. And usually it is margin calls. People sell gold because they can. We must also add, much of the quote unquote gold held by institution is in derivative form, which means paper gold. Yet the perceived safety is equal to the physical gold in these peer-to-peer, computer-to-computer, trading house to trading house, bank to bank, and hedge fund to hedge fund type of transactions. They look at it as being as good as gold, when in reality a lot of it is not. But nonetheless, it has the word gold in it, and for a time it satisfies that requirement. And lastly is oblivion. In the fifth and last stage, is when it is reached, total systemic collapse is in store. This is what almost happened, as we've said twice on this show, on a global basis during the 2008 meltdown. And we still haven't recovered. I mean, let's say I've been criticized, as many of us, that, you know, well, it never happened. You guys are gloom and doomers.
Right.
And, you know, and the thing is, if you just do here is where I get a little on my high horse, and I'm allowed at my age to be on a high horse from time to time, where if anyone that really wanted to think and be objective to themselves, I don't care if they're my friend or not, but they really want to examine this from an objective perspective, go to a Google search engine or any good search engine and type in major bankruptcy since 2008 and let Google show you all the major failures besides Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. We're not just talking investment banks. We're talking major corporations that failed completely since 2008. And if you can look at that and say that we haven't had a failure of the system, and the reason that people don't understand how bad it is because it doesn't affect them directly. I remember when I was, you know, what I call my previous lifetime and worked in the aircraft industry. And my friend and I were always into economics. It's been my passion from day one almost. And we would joke, or his joke, he said it to me, was that, you know, you're in a recession when, you know, times are bad and you know, your neighbor loses their, but when you lose your job and can't find another one, then it's a depression. And I said that little corny joke to say this, unless it seems to affect these people directly, then they don't seem to comprehend what the physical economy is, how much it's been deteriorating for the last several years. And also, they have no perspective because of their age, and that's okay. I try to be understanding of that. But if they're 30 living in the basement and just, you know, getting their troll satisfaction out of their life, they really don't understand that the lost opportunity that we haven't provided for them is something that, you know, we have to take some responsibility for. At least that's how I see it, because it was our duty to stand up for the principles that have been lost through the Republic, and not enough people were willing to stand up, put their neck out, and put, you know, something on the line of value that meant something for our future generations. I mean, I sat there and, you know, I've been, you know, a nut job for most of my life, so I'm very comfortable in this position because I have no trouble speaking, you know, what's factually true and giving my opinion. Not everything I say is fact, but a lot of it is. I try to stay as close to the facts as possible. And this is because the only way that people understand how valuable freedom is, unfortunately, is to lose it. And we have been losing it, and it isn't gradual anymore. The boiling frog scenario is a good example, except right now, as a metaphor, we're at about 211 degrees. We've got one more degree to go, and we're all boiled, and it's over.
You mentioned the seriousness. I remember reading a quote, and I'll try to pull it up by the time we're done and see if I can include it in the write-up of this. But there was a quote 5 years after the 2008 collapse where a high-level banker, I believe, or government official was saying, we realized we were standing on the edge of the precipice and looking into the abyss, and that within a few hours, everything would be wiped away. If that's how serious the those who were in the know realized things were back in 2008, how are things now in relative to 2008 in terms of the gravity of the true risk? Because we have some people on our channel who say, well, just make reparations to get through about a month, or some people said a couple months, and then the system will right itself and we'll be off to the races again. But can you give us your, based on the research that you've done and the people that you've talked with, what shape are we in now compared to 2008? And when the next collapse happens, not if, but when, how serious and how difficult to get out of do you picture it being?
A great question. First of all, no one really knows. And no matter what scenario anyone comes up with, Martin Armstrong, myself, or, you know, whomever, it'll probably be somewhat different. As far as where we, if you compare it to where we were in 2008, it's much worse. There's fewer bigger banks. They're bigger than they ever were. And there's more derivatives out there than ever before. So as far as from that metric, it appears as if we are in a bigger problem than ever before. However, going back to Jim Rickards, there's a possibility that we've mitigated it somewhat on a global basis, because the AIIB, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, has got a clearing system outside the SWIFT system, which actually is like a firewall between what's done with the Anglo-American Empire through London and New York, has been circumvented to a different clearing system for the BRICS countries. So that's something that could mitigate a worldwide collapse. You also have IMF has brought the yuan under their domain of currencies, global currencies that make up what the special drawing rights could be, which Jim has stated in his last two books, last two or three, that could be used as the banker's last resort of quote unquote paper money to fix the system if there was to be the start of a systemic collapse again. So I have to look at all pictures that I can think of and think critically. Nonetheless, the facts are that we're in far worse shape than we were in 2008. If it were to start and they were not able to, you know, look over the abyss and pull their head back, in other words, they fall into the abyss, which as a metaphor, we're doomed. However, These people are not ignorant. They are very savvy about what's going on, and they will not ever say it in the public domain. And it's really not the big banks, although they're very much involved. But I'm talking about, let's say, the highest level banks like the BIS that really don't publish too much in the public domain. And what they do publish in the public domain is vetted, you know, several times. And it's kind of geared down for the masses. And there's very few in the masses that even read their stuff, people like myself and others. But nonetheless, so I got off track somewhat. No, we are in a position where I think the probability to give percentages on it is the next time it happens, and that's not an if, it's a when, I think we have about an 80% probability that it will go down and not be recoverable.
What kind of a outcome does that give an ordinary person? If you could just spell out a couple of the main implications of that kind of a financial lockup and how that would affect people's ordinary lives first, before we go on.
Sure. And I don't know if they took it from me or not, doesn't matter. I mean, we all think similarly, but no one, you know, in the group of, let's say, alternative media, economists, economic thinkers, hard money people, whatever you want to term us, I don't really care. One thing that I'm almost certain of is you will have access to your money, but on a limited basis. So it'll be very similar to what I give in that Riches and Resources report that I give out for free when you sign up for our free e-letter. And that's where you're able to go to your bank, but you're only able to withdraw, you know, 60 euros at a time per day or 300 US dollars per week or whatever. So the banks will say, well, we haven't failed. Your money's still here. It's just that we're putting limits on how much you can grab or how much you can obtain, which really curtails, you know, the economic system, the physical economy in a great deal, because if one, you couldn't withdraw enough in, you know, months time to pay your rent, then what happens?
Yeah.
Or you got a, you know, a balloon payment due on a mortgage, or you owe your brother-in-law some, or whatever. And this is why it's so imperative to have a monetary asset or assets outside of the system. I mean, hard cash, I'm not a big, you know, lover of the Federal Reserve system, as anyone knows, but nonetheless, they're very accepted worldwide. I mean, most of these currency failures that have happened over the years that we talked about from 1990 in our second book, The Silver Manifesto. I mean, there's been so many, people don't realize it, but the reason that they don't really come to the fore is, one, the mainstream press suppresses it. And secondly, most of these people, or countries, I should say, and people of those countries, immediately go on a U.S. dollar standard, which they're on most of the time anyway. In other words, that they're, whatever their currency unit is that's failing, they will just revert to U.S. dollars because there's so many dollars overseas. And this is something that no one really thinks about unless they think about it. So I am, I think I've said enough. We can probably move on to the next question. Thanks.
Well, just the gravity of the coming collapse, how it'll affect the ordinary person.
Yeah, so the banks will seize up to a degree. So they'll limit the cash to the capital controls. You won't be able to move cash out of the country, whatever you saved. And the economic system will start grinding to even a lower level. And there'll be areas that will be different than other areas. I mean, for example, if you're more rural, you probably have a better lifestyle, or things will be less noticeable than if you're in a very dense populated area, such as any inner city. That's where you'll have probably the most stress on, not only on system, because there'll be people that will be looking toward the local authorities, the local governments, systems to provide what they always have. But they'll be inundated with new people in line to get, you know, something from some benefactor, which usually means some authority from the federal government or the state government. Anything that's on a private basis, like a union mission or a food bank or anything like that, will be at a very high stress level, and they won't be able to cope with it. And I think because the moral structure of society is not at a level that it was during the Great Depression, they'll probably be more possibilities of, you know, riots and that kind of thing in those type of situations. So I think it could get ugly in places. I want to be optimistic. I want to think that, you know, the high moral structure of people that understand what's going on can stand quietly in line and get along and that type of thing. But I think that's unrealistic. So it depends, one, where you're at, two, what you've saved or what you've prepared for, three, what you can bring to the party, and I use party in quotation marks, because it is important to set an example and take the high road as much as possible, there is this mob mentality that can take hold very easily, but it can work both directions. It's not always one direction. So someone that's, let's say, more adult acting than, let's say, some others might be able to quell a crowd before things get out of hand. Now, does that take place all the time? No, but I just want to throw it out there because you asked, and it's important to at least have these thoughts in mind before they happen, because the best thing that can happen in the worst conditions is for everybody to be something valuable, because there's nothing in our society, if you believe in the Christian values that this country was founded on, more valuable than a human life, because there's souls. I mean, I've talked about this before. I mean, again, getting way off track, but you know, when you're in you're in a test airplane condition, okay, you're in a flight test situation, or even in a fighter situation, and it's peacetime, but there's something that goes awry at the aircraft and you start yelling Mayday, the first thing that the ground control center asks are how many souls are on board. You don't get that in Russia, you don't get that anywhere else, but in the United States, or in the English-speaking world for the most part, the UK as well, they would ask you how many souls are on board. And that sounds rather interesting until you realize that at some level, we value human life very, very much. And yet in a mob situation, crowd situation, that seems to be forgotten. So I just want to remind everybody that even cares to listen to this interview that, you know what, you do have to value what's important. And if you're not important or your neighbor isn't important, and what the heck is really going on? You know, I think these are questions that we don't even talk about on these kind of shows, but they need to be. And I know you always give me free rein, and I appreciate that. And almost everybody that interviews me does. And I don't get on this philosophical thing too often, but it bothers me because I see this thing coming. I see it accelerating. I see it's inevitable. And I really, if I could, and maybe this little diatribe will help somebody somewhere at some time suck it up and say, you know what, look, I'm going to put my hands up and say, look, let's just calm down. You know, there's enough here to go around. Let's make the best of what we have and not focus on what we don't have.
We've even got some close acquaintances who are preparing for a potential collapse and emergency situations by storing up different supplies. And for example, one of the things that they've stored up way more than their family, and they have a lot of kids, but way more than their family can possibly use is, for example, hooded sweatshirts. They find something on clearance sale or something, they'll just stock up, fill a closet full of those, because in an emergency situation, if somebody comes saying, hey, I want your whatever it is, I want you to give it to me, they may be able to have something to offer. Say, listen, I don't have that to spare, but here's what I can do to help you, and have something that they can give. So already planning ahead how they can be generous in a time of great want, I think shows some of that integrity of character that you're talking about.
Absolutely. On a personal level, just get on that tangent. I've got more wheat than I could ever eat, and it's non-hybrid. So you could actually eat, you know, grind some, and you could plant some. So what would be better than that than giving, you know, 100 pounds to my neighbors that they can go eat it immediately and, you know, plant it as well. So, you know, if that's just one that I thought about a long time ago, this is going to save the world, no, but it's better than not being able to offer them something.
Yeah, and it's tricky. We've had Brad Harris, the founder of Full Spectrum Survival, on, and he's talked about having barter goods available, but that you also need to think through well in advance the scenarios of how you would keep it safe for yourself and safe for your family and not become a victim, just because if people in a difficult or desperate situation suddenly know, oh, they can start to see you as a resource and want to plunder you. Just that's, you know, can be that kind of that mob human nature that you mentioned. We can kind of fall to our basis instincts if people start to panic. But being able to plan where would be a safe way to be able to give and to trade and that sort of thing. Just returning back to our main question about the plight that our system has placed us in through its complexity. One thing that we didn't really talk about, you did mention it in passing, but I wondered if you could give us a little bit deeper understanding, is why is it back to that principle of why is it that a larger and more interconnected system is more vulnerable?
Well, it goes back to complexity theory. I mean, if you've got, you know, an aircraft engine or even an automobile engine, and you've got so many, you know, moving parts, I mean, that's a complicated system. So you could have one hose that's a vacuum line that, you know, comes apart, or the seal breaks on something, and all of a sudden the whole system comes down. So that's a good metaphor for a complicated system. And it amazes me whenever I'm in a, you know, very large city, because I live in a rather modest sized city. But when I'm in, you know, New York or Hong Kong or Paris or whatever, and I just, all these mouths that need to get fed every day, and no one even thinks about it. It's like, it's a complex system. Just yeah. Not even talking about growing the food, just transporting the food from the nearest port over the roadways to the stores and restaurants, and then everyone, including myself, because I don't think of it that often, takes it for granted. It's like, you know, that wonderful restaurant or that, you know, grocery store or whatever, it's always going to be there. And you know what? Time, history has taught us differently, but very complicated. And, you know, there's so many points of failure that could happen. And I don't want to, you know, stay on this, oh, gloom. I know that people get distraught. I know that people, you know, rather put on a happy face. I try to be realistic about it. I really do. But nonetheless, I think there's two scenarios. One is you could over-prepare. You could just think of nothing about gloom, prepare, and that's your whole focus. Right. I think that's being very imbalanced. The other thing is, oh, these doom and gloomers are full of it. You know, they don't know what they're talking about. It's never happened. It hasn't happened yet. 2008, we're well past it, and on. So that's the opposite extreme, which is not to prepare at all. I think you need to be balanced. You need to be somewhere in the middle between those two extremes to prepare, not even for an economic collapse, just for a weather event or some type of emergency where maybe you're going to lose your job. Just think of, you know, there's a lot of people that had this stored food and they, you know, make fun of us that have it. But some experiences that there are people that have lost their, could get another one for quite some time, and they were down to like a low bank account, but they had 3 or 4 months worth of food, and they were doggone glad they had it because they were able to live on it.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is it gives you options and that gives you freedom. But I did want to just agree with you on that previous point you had made about everyone's going to die sometime. So don't forget to live before that. You know, don't make, you know, preparing for the end your the obsession that takes away your opportunity to find joy, to find blessings, to find, you know, gratitude in this moment and in moments to come. Before we let you go, could you hit us one time with the how people can take advantage of volatility that does exist, as you've often pointed out, in the silver market, to cost average, to continue to build that asset that does not have counterparty risk on their part?
Yeah, I think the best thing is go to one of my domains, which is richesandresources.com. It's all one word, richesandresources.com, and just get our free Riches and Resources report. In that report, there's a couple of offers or opportunities, I should say, for those that like to stack or dollar cost average, that you can not only buy silver, but you can be paid in silver just by sharing this with your friends. And it is not MLM. It's your efforts, whatever your efforts determine, help you to acquire silver basically for free, just for sharing the word. But it's not, you know, I'm not an MLM type, so I wouldn't promote one. But this program is one that's very beneficial to all parties, and they just don't do any direct advertising. They let the people that are involved in this silver gold savings program be their marketing arm.
That's Riches and Resources?
Yes, Riches in Resources.
Riches in Resources. Okay. And before we let you go, can you let us know, people know where they can find out more of your work on The Morgan Report?
Sure. The main website's themorganreport.com. And that, of course, is the best one to go to get on our free email list. And you will get good information on a weekly basis. And you will also get some offers, because I do give the opportunity to use that list from time to time to outside sources that I vet, because, you know, I've got to run a business here, and it's not all for free. We're not involved enough yet to have a society without money. Maybe someday, but not right now.
Well, David, just really appreciate you always visiting us here on Reluctant Preppers and giving us your experience from wisdom from your experience that you've had, as well as this subject matter expertise you've got in the precious metals arena, to give us that perspective as well. So thanks again for joining us here on Reluctant Preppers.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is the Morgan Report with David Morgan. For the latest in precious metals investing, gold, silver, the economy, and more, go to themorganreport.com.